The New Deal, going off gold. The international monetary system that the House of Morgan helped Great Britain cobble together in 1925 lay in ruins when Britain hastily abandoned the gold exchange standard in late September 1931. The Morgans tried desperately to keep Britain on gold in 1931, and afterward tried to get their bearings in the newly chaotic monetary arena. By the time of Roosevelt's accession to power in the spring of 1933, the Morgans had thrown in the towel on the American gold coin standard. Indeed, the Morgan-oriented leadership at the Treasury, Mills and Ballantyne, had been agitating for going off gold considerably earlier. But the overriding Morgan concern was always their associates and colleagues in England, and they hoped for a rapid return to some kind of fixed exchange rate relation to Britain, and perhaps, by extension, to the other major European currencies as well. The Morgans wanted to reconstruct a regime of monetary internationalism as soon as possible. But for the first time since the turn of the century, the Morgans were no longer dominant over the monetary thinking of American financial and business elites. In the midst of the cauldron of depression, a new economic and monetary nationalism, a desire for domestic inflation untrammeled by international monetary responsibilities, began to take hold. Backed by proto-monetarist and proto-Keynesian economists eager to spur inflationist federal policies to cure the depression, the shift of business groups toward inflation centered in farm and agribusiness groups, which had been agitating for higher farm prices since the early 1920s, and in industrialists making products for the retail market, who wanted government to pour new money into consumption spending. Thus, in January 1933, powerful business groups formed the Committee for the Nation, more formally, the Committee for the Nation to Rebuild Prices and Purchasing Power, dedicated to getting the government to, quote, reflate prices back up to 1929 levels, and to get off the gold standard so that the government could issue fiat paper money for that purpose. The co-defenders of the Committee for the Nation were Vincent Bendix, head of Bendix Aviation, and General Robert E. Wood, head of the mighty retail combine of Sears Roebuck. Others who soon joined them were Frank A. Vanderlip, former president of the National City Bank of New York, the flagship bank in the Rockefeller orbit, James H. Rand, Jr., president of Remington Rand Company, manufacturer of typewriters and other retail products, Lessing Rosenwald, major owner of Sears Roebuck, Samuel S. Fells, producer of Fells Naphtha, Philip K. Wrigley, head of William J. Wrigley Company, E. L. Cord of the Cord Automobile Company, William J. McAvinney, president of Hudson Motor Company, R. F. Wurlitzer, producer of Wurlitzer Musical Instruments, Frederick H. Fraser, chairman of the board of the General Baking Company, and a galaxy of farm leaders. Fred H. Sixauer, president of the Dairymen's League Cooperative Association, Edward A. O'Neill, head of the American Farm Bureau Federation, and Louis J. Tabor, head of the National Grange. It should also be noted that Rockefeller's petroleum products were, of course, goods largely sold at retail. Another emboldened inflationist group was the silver mining interests, centered in the mountain states, which seemingly had lost out permanently to the McKinley and Republican gold forces in the 1890s. Mountain state senators led the silver bloc in Congress, and Senator Burton K. Wheeler, Democrat from Montana, introduced a bimetallic bill to reinstitute the silver-gold standard at the old 19th-century ratio of 16 to 1. Leading theoretician and lobbyist for the silver bloc was New York banker René Leon, who got himself appointed as advisor to the House Ways and Means Committee in unsuccessfully pressing for an international conference to raise silver prices. More generally, the Rockefeller and Harriman forces had been allied against the Morgans since the turn of the century, and now they and other rising financial groups banded together avidly to overthrow and dethrone the financial and political dominance achieved by the House of Morgan during the Republican decade of the 1920s. Again, influential in the new democratic regime was the veteran speculator and political manipulator Bernard Baruch, who had been czar of the collectivized economy as head of the War Industries Board in World War I, and who yearned to reestablish a similar, collectivist, cartelized regime in peacetime, using the Depression as the means for achieving this goal. Baruch, since childhood, had been a protege of the powerful Guggenheim family, who controlled the American copper industry, but who liked to keep a low political profile and operate through Baruch and his network of operatives. Newer Jewish Wall Street investment banking houses, more anti-Morgan than Kuhn Leb, were also rising to help challenge Morgan, notably Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers. The Lehman family contributing New Deal governor of New York, Herbert H. Lehman, to the American political scene. Furthermore, Jewish retail interests, led by the Boston Fallien brothers, were in favor of more inflation and consumer spending. And longtime Fallien and retailer attorney Louis D. Brandeis had become powerful in the Democratic Party and was helping run the New Deal surreptitiously from his seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. Brandeis was a longtime enemy of the Morgans as attorney for opposing corporate interests and a dedicated supporter of retail cartels supported by the government. Moreover, all these financial and industrial groups were swinging notably leftward, not simply in monetary matters, but also in advocating far more government intervention, including promotion of labor unions, than the Morgans were willing to accept. Thus, these anti-Morgan groups, now gathered in the Democratic Party, were happy to form a coalition with left-wing intellectuals, technocrats, economists, and social workers who wished to staff the planning agencies, all to advance their common New Deal and ultra-statist agenda. Particularly powerful in the New Deal and in the Democratic Party was the underrated W. Averill Harriman, scion of the great Harriman interests and longtime enemy of the Morgans. Harriman dominated a highly influential new agency set up in the New Deal, the Business Advisory Council, or BAC, of the Department of Commerce, which transmitted the influence of the pro-New Deal wing of industry and finance. Also dominant in the BAC was Sidney J. Weinberg of Goldman Sachs. The Franklin Roosevelt, High Park, Democrat wing of the Roosevelt family had always been close to their Hudson Valley neighbors, the Astors and the Harrimans, whereas the Oyster Bay, Theodore Roosevelt, Republican wing of the family had always been close to the Morgans. To return to monetary policy, Eugene Meyer, who, after all, had 3 years to go in a 10-year term as governor of the Federal Reserve Board, refused President Hoover's request to resign immediately upon the inauguration of President Roosevelt. But Meyer found out quickly that he could not agree to going off the gold standard and an inflationary higher gold price, and he tendered his resignation as Fed chief in early May 1933. President Roosevelt's early monetary appointments set an important signal of his new orientation and policies. To succeed Meyer, Roosevelt appointed his friend, the young Georgia banker Eugene R. Black, who had been governor of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Black's orientation may be gauged by the fact that, when he left the Fed a year later, he was to spend 16 years climbing up the executive ladder at the powerful Chase National Bank, which by this time had shifted firmly from the Morgan to the Rockefeller camp. Indeed, for the rest of his working life, Eugene Black was to serve at Chase as protege of none other than the eminent Winthrop W. Aldrich, chairman of the board at Chase and a close kinsman of the Rockefeller family. Roosevelt's first Secretary of the Treasury was William H. Wooden, who received the appointment after it was turned down by Melvin Traylor, president of the First National Bank of Chicago, one of the main commercial banks in the Rockefeller orbit. Wooden had spent most of his career as a high official of the American Car and Foundry Company in New York, and was now chairman of the board of the American Locomotive Company. Wooden was also a director of such important enterprises as the Harriman-controlled American Ship and Commerce Corporation, as well as the Rockefeller-dominated Remington Arms Company. He had also been a founding director of the County Trust Company of New York, along with the influential Vincent Astor and Herbert H. Lehman, Wooden's financial associations in New York were therefore in the Harriman, Astor, Lehman, Rockefeller ambit, rather than in the Morgan network. Ill health forced Wooden to resign in December 1933, however, and his place was taken by Henry Morgenthau Jr., who was to be an important and controversial Treasury Secretary for the remainder of Roosevelt's reign in office. Morgenthau, who rose from Undersecretary, was a longtime friend and neighbor of Roosevelt's, and a gentleman farmer interested in agriculture. He was backed by his wealthy father, who had been ambassador to Turkey under Wilson, but more important was Henry Jr.'s close links to the powerful investment banking family of Lehman Brothers. Indeed, Henry Jr. was married to a Lehman. Her mother was a sister of Herbert H. and Arthur Lehman, and Henry's nephew, Jules Erich, had married a sister of Philip Lehman. Moreover, Henry Sr. had long been a major stockholder of the Underwood Typewriter Company, and several of his fellow board members were Philip Lehman, Philip's cousin Arthur Lehman, Morris Wertheim, who had married Henry Jr.'s sister, Alma, and Waddell Catchings, a top official of Goldman Sachs. Two fateful monetary steps were taken in 1933 by the incoming Roosevelt administration. The first and most revolutionary deed, accomplished in April, was to go off the gold standard, to confiscate almost all the gold of American citizens and place it under the ownership of the Federal Reserve, to embargo the export of gold, and to devalue the dollar to $35 a gold ounce. This swift policy carried out almost completely the program of the Committee for the Nation. But in March and April, even the Morgans had been convinced by the banking crisis to go off gold. Democratic Morgan partner Russell Leffingwell was influential in urging Roosevelt to go off gold and devalue the dollar. And Jack Morgan himself applauded Roosevelt's decision to inflate and go off gold. The major theoretician of the inflationists, who had liquidated the assets of his own prior stable money association into the Committee for the Nation, was Yale professor Irving Fisher, the intellectual forerunner of Milton Friedman, who has hailed Fisher as, quote, the greatest economist of the 20th century, and who mechanistically had believed that since the price level was not rising in the 1920s, there was no inflation to worry about and no coming crash. Fisher strongly urged the inflationist devaluation and fiat standard upon Roosevelt, who had asked him for advice. When Roosevelt cast the die against gold, Fisher exulted to his wife, quote, now I am sure, as far as we ever can be sure of anything, that we are going to snap out of this depression fast. I am now one of the happiest men in the world. End quote. Fisher had a personal as well as an ideological stake in rapid inflation. Sure of a permanent prosperity and stock boom in the late 1920s, he had invested all of his wife's and most of his sister-in-law's substantial Hazard family fortune in the stock market, and he was desperately anxious for Roosevelt to reflate and drive up stock prices. As Fisher added in the same letter to his wife, quote, I mean that if FDR had followed Glass, who had urged him to stay on gold, we would have been pretty surely ruined, end quote. As it happened, the fiat money policy did not restore the stock market, and Fisher's and his wife's and sister-in-law's fortune was ruined by his unwise speculations, a mute testimony to the unsoundness of Fisher and monetarism in explaining or counteracting business cycles. On the other side of the gold standard decision were the bulk of the nation's economists, who signed a mass petition urging immediate return to gold. They were led by two doughty, hard-money men, Dr. H. Parker Willis, who had staunchly opposed the strong Morgan inflationism of the 1920s and urged rapid liquidation of unsound assets to promote recovery, and Dr. Benjamin M. Anderson, longtime hard-money economist of Chase National Bank, who had influenced Chase President Albert Wiggin in favor of hard money and laissez-faire policies. In the executive branch, the major opponent of the new fiat regime was Lewis W. Douglas, Arizona scion of the Phelps Dodge copper mining interests, and Roosevelt's head of the Bureau of Budget. the fiscally conservative Douglas had, in early 1933, persuaded Roosevelt to make severe cuts in the proposed appropriations of the executive agencies. Even though monetary nationalism had triumphed, the Morgan interests and the other monetary internationalists were anxious to reestablish fixed exchange rates with Britain and to rebuild the special relationship with Morgan allies in Britain and Western Europe. The ultra-inflationists, led by the Committee for the Nation, were strongly opposed to fixed exchange rates with Britain and wanted to press ahead with monetary or dollar nationalism, higher gold prices, and continued inflation. Tensions within the administration and within the industrial and financial communities centered around the World Economic Conference set for London in June 1933, which had been prepared for a year by the British-dominated League of Nations in a desperate attempt to restore some sort of fixed exchange rate, stabilized international monetary system. The World Economic Conference, with delegates from 64 nations, met on June 12th. The gold bloc at the conference, led by the French, urged an immediate restoration of the full, classical gold standard. The British wanted fixed exchange rates, tied to gold or not, but emphasizing that the pound must be cheaper at $4 so as not to lose the export advantage Britain had built up in the past 2 years. The United States, on the other hand, wanted to place prime emphasis on continued domestic inflation, currency stabilization, which should not put the pound below $4.25, could wait until some future date after domestic prices had risen. From the beginning, however, there was great tension between the bulk of the American delegation to London and the Roosevelt administration in Washington. Chief economic advisor to the American delegation was James P. Warburg of Kuhn Loeb, who took the Morgan line of favoring a new international gold standard at new and more realistic exchange rates. Morgan oriented George L. Harrison of the New York Fed and Professor O.M. W. Sprague were sent by FDR to work on an agreement for temporary stabilization of exchange rates for the duration of the conference. When, however, Sprague and Harrison concluded an agreement on June 16th with the British and French for temporary stabilization of the three currencies, setting the dollar sterling rate at $4 a pound and pledging the United States not to inflate the currency in the meanwhile, Roosevelt angrily rejected the agreement. Roosevelt gave two reasons to the chagrin Sprague and Harrison. The pound must be no cheaper than $4.25, and Roosevelt could accept no restraint on his freedom to inflate to raise domestic prices. Harrison quit in disgust and returned home, a harbinger of the fate of the Morgans in the years to come. The World Economic Conference proceeded with lengthy discussions, both the Americans and British talking about an eventual, quote, gold standard, which would enjoy no domestic gold coin or bullion circulation, with gold to be used only as a medium for settling international balances of payments, a foretaste of the eventual Bretton Woods system after World War II. The stubbornness of the United States finally forced the assembled delegates to agree on an innocuous final declaration at the end of June that committed the United States to very little more than its own resolution for eventual return to a sadly denatured gold standard, coupled with a vague agreement to cooperate in limiting exchange rate speculation. This declaration, weak as it was, seemed to offer hope of eventual stabilization. And so it was strongly supported by Sprague, Warburg, and by Chief Brain Truster Raymond Moley, Assistant Secretary of State, who was head of the American delegation to London. Within the administration, the agreement was strongly supported by Douglas, Baruch, and by Undersecretary of the Treasury Dean G. Acheson. Acheson was a disciple of Morgan-oriented lawyer Henry L. Stimson, and one of his Washington law partners, J. Harry Covington, was a director of the Guggenheim-controlled Kennecott Copper Corporation. Sending the proposed declaration to Roosevelt on June 30th, Moley pointed out that dollar depreciation during June had brought the pound-dollar rate up to $4.40, well above the $4.25 that Roosevelt had insisted on. On July 1st, however, FDR stunned Moley, the delegates, and the American supporters of the agreement by flatly rejecting the declaration, stating that the United States should be allowed the time, quote, to permit a demonstration of the value of price-lifting efforts, which we have well in hand, end quote. But, adding insult to injury, Roosevelt followed up this rejection on July 3rd with an arrogant and contemptuous message to the London conference, which became known as his famous, quote, bombshell message. Here, Roosevelt denounced any idea of currency stabilization as a, quote, specious fallacy. In particular, he thundered, quote, old fetishes of so-called international bankers are being replaced by efforts to plan national currencies, end quote, in order to obtain a fixed price level. In short, Roosevelt now totally and publicly committed to the entire Nationalist Fisher Committee for the Nation program for fiat paper money, currency inflation, and a very steep, quote, reflation of prices. The idea of stable exchange rates or an international monetary order would fade away for the remainder of the 1930s, and monetary nationalism, currency blocks, and economic warfare would be the order of the day for the remainder of the decade. The chagrined supporters of the aborted London Monetary Agreement soon found it necessary to leave the Roosevelt administration. This included Acheson, Warburg, who had been offered the job of Under Secretary of the Treasury before Acheson, and who was close to his ancient Kuhn-Leb allies, the Harriman interests, Lewis W. Douglas, who was soon to write a bitter book attacking the New Deal, and Moley, who returned to the Academy and who helped run Today and Newsweek with his friends the Astors and the Harrimans. The Committee for the Nation has long been known as the prime mover behind the fiat money and inflationist policy of the early New Deal. What has not been known until recently was the powerful, behind-the-scenes role in the committee played by the Rockefeller Empire, in conjunction with their longtime international rival, the British Royal Dutch Shell Oil, financed by the Rothschild interests. Thus, a top financier of the Committee for the Nation was James A. Moffat, a longtime director and high official of the Rockefeller flagship company, the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey. Moffat, friend and early supporter of Roosevelt, coordinated his behind-the-scenes agitation for inflation and against the London Economic Conference with New York banker and leading Silver Bloc agitator René Leon, who functioned as an agent for the powerful Sir Henry Dieterding, head of Royal Dutch Shell, who was heading the international agitation for a worldwide cartelized increase in the price of silver. Dieterding pressured Roosevelt for inflation, not so much in his capacity as an oil leader, as in a financier of silver production. It turns out that Moffat and Leon, working in tandem, were most influential in successfully pressuring Roosevelt to torpedo the London Economic Conference. Here was a startlingly clear case of Rockefeller and Royal Dutch Shell against Morgan.